Very good. So I think people are finding spaces. So you have to go here very early on a Friday night to get a good spot. Even if Justin Bieber was giving the talk tonight, you wouldn't get it's even fuller. Whoever else. So there you go, welcome to today's talk. I'll start now. And usually something comes up during the week, or actually it was last Sunday when I gave the sutta class and a teaching from the original authentic teachings of the Buddha. I was reading out one teaching, and it brought back some nostalgia for me, because it was the first time which in my life as a Buddhist monk I read about the Buddha indicating this very powerful concept of the fault-finding mind. And just how troublesome that is. And that it was one of the causes of so many problems and suffering in this world. The cause of so many arguments, and also a great cause of lack of success and peace in meditation, the fault-finding mind. And the opposite of the fault-finding mind is the beautiful mind of respect, of gratitude, of kindness, of embracing things rather than always finding fault with it. But I wanted to talk about those two concepts today, and just to warn you that be careful of that fault-finding mind. And it's one of those attitudes which is so embedded in our modern Western world, where it never used to be. We are such great fault finders, and it's so easy to find fault with things. It's easy to find fault, you know, with this beautiful center which took years to build. It's easy to find fault, you know, with your husband and wife. And so often when people come up and they have these problems, I can't understand why you can't get on together. You know, because I look at both of these people, and I've known you for years, and you're just such beautiful, good people. You're not the best, you're not perfect, but no one is. But you're really good enough, and I don't see how you can't live together in peace if you start respecting one another and start finding faults with one another all the time. But unfortunately, that becomes our habit. We do that at work, always finding fault with the company, with the boss, with the workers, with everything. We find fault with the government, we find fault with the transport, the freeway is blocked again. We find fault with the weather, it's getting hotter, we find fault with the salary, it's not enough. We find fault with everything. And you know what it's like when you get into that mode? It's very easy to do. Anyone can do that. But you do want to be like those people who are always criticizing and finding fault. Those people, they can't live with anybody, because no one ever is perfect enough for your fault-finding mind. But even worse, when you find fault with the world, when you find fault with other people, the next stage is finding fault with yourself. And oh God, you're in trouble then. You can always leave work. You can always migrate to another country. You can always leave your partner. But you can never escape from yourself. Wherever you go in this world, you take you with you. And even if you try and escape in drink and drugs, when you wake up in the morning, there you are again. So, even if those people who try to commit suicide, we don't try and encourage suicide in Buddhism. Not because it's something evil or against some divine law. It's because it doesn't work. You kill yourself, and when you get reincarnated, here I am again. Nothing works. So look, that fault-finding mind is the problem. So how can we, when we actually see that, just be really careful. Just how you use your speech and your mind. It's so easy to do, to find those faults. But can't we look at life in a different way? And look at life in a different way is we deliberately don't look for the faults in things, but respect them and look for the beauty in things. All it needs is just a slight change of attitude. We call it kindness, we call it compassion, we call it gratitude, we call it developing, this is to show that I don't make these things up, developing the subanimitta. That's Pali, how the Buddha taught. It's developing the perception of the beautiful. And it's not something which is just there, it's something which you cultivate. To see the beauty in your old grandma. Old grandma, 80 years of age, broken teeth, wrinkled skin, can't remember even what your name is, but she's gorgeous, she's my grandma. Can you develop that perception of the beautiful? Why is it, if it's someone like your grandma, you love her to bits, that's why you can respect her and feel grateful for her. They all come together, you don't find fault with these things. But why is it that we don't develop that sort of attitude, seeing the beauty, even in the old thing? I don't know why it is, even just before I came in here, somebody wanted to take a photograph of me. I can't understand why you want to take a photograph of an old fat monk. I am not Justin Bieber. I am not hot. I'm an old monk, for goodness sake. But somehow you can see something beautiful in that, which is why people like taking those photographs. When you really look for things, you can look for the beauty in other things. And that is beautiful, what makes, you know, the world. Looking for the beautiful, you see it, and that makes happiness, but not just happiness, a great deal of harmony and a great deal of positiveness in our world. What a beautiful sound that mobile phone made. Yeah, I know it should be turned off, but no, that's wonderful. So I'm not going to find fault with your mobile phones. What a wonderful opportunity that was for me to comment about how often can you find fault and say, turn that mobile phone off. Or what I usually say, if your mobile phone goes off during a talk or during meditation, even the phone makes bad karma. And in its next life, it will be reborn as a parking meter. Which is the lowest form of life for technological instruments. But you don't find fault like that. Instead, you have this beautiful sense of gratitude. Because a good example of this is one of the stories which comes up. Some years ago, I forget now, 4, 5, 6 years ago, it was the first time I was invited to give a talk at Christchurch Grammar School here in Perth. And they're a top private school, a Christian school. And the reason was because the chaplain there, Frank Sheehan, was a good mate. We met on many things and he respected me. Come and give a talk at our school. So I turned up there early one morning for the school assembly. I was going to talk to all of the children in this Christian school at the school assembly. So I had to wait outside with the headmaster, I think Gareth White, and Frank Sheehan and myself for all the classrooms to actually assemble there, all the children there, and everyone become quiet, where we'd actually make a procession in. Now, this is one of these schools, the private schools, with a great sense of respect. And before we walked in, the headmaster, the principal said, this is a Christian school. We're going to start with a Christian ceremony. In the auditorium, wherever it was, there is a little statue of Jesus Christ. And, you know, myself and Frank Sheehan, the chaplain, we're going to do a little bow to the statue of Jesus. But he said, you're a Buddhist monk, you don't need to do that. And I saw my opportunity. I looked at the principal, and I was quite fierce, and I said, sir, I demand my right to bow to your Jesus. And I did that because I wanted to say something really important. I said, yes, as a Buddhist monk, I can very easily find fault with Christianity. I can have that fault-finding mind. But what does that really serve in our modern world? That just makes divisions, it makes bad feelings, we can't have any harmony, always competing with each other, who's got the best religion and the best truth. Is that the sort of world which I want to create and live in and leave for other people? No way. And I told him, look, there's many things in your religion I don't agree with. You know, such as circumcision. I told people today that was one of the reasons I didn't want to become a Jew. But there's lots of things I respect in your religion. And I said, that is what I'm going to bow towards. That part of Christianity which I respect. I wasn't going to have a fault-finding mind. I was going to have a totally different mind which sees the beautiful in something. And that was a wonderful moment when the three of us could bow to a Christian symbol. And I was a very, very strong Buddhist for so many years. Now you can see what that does. That is one example of how we can have this lack of fault finding and gratitude and the beauty of it and the results which such lack of fault-finding, but gratitude, seeing the good of something, actually does. You know what happened later on? You know, the headmaster, he came to Bodhinyana Monastery to come and do some meditation there later on. You see, we almost get a convert. Not quite, but close. But at least we built up the respect for one another. And because we have that respect for one another, we don't have these arguments, these fights, these wars, and all the other stuff which comes from fault-finding. We all know how much terrorism there is in this world. And how much argument. I'm not talking about terrorism in that Boston Marathon. I'm talking about the terrorism in Parliament House in Canberra. Arguing with each other and shouting and acting disgusting towards each other. And you know, no one really likes that. Why do people do that? Because we have a system of always finding fault with one another. And that's one of the reasons I gave this talk this evening, because I was reading in the British papers. The British papers couldn't believe why people don't respect the governments in Australia. Both sides, or three sides, the Greens as well, they've done a pretty good job compared to what's happening in Europe. But why is it we always find fault with people so greatly? That is a disease which creates a lot of anger and a lot of dysfunction. We can't get anywhere in life when we're just arguing with one another. But instead of arguing and because we find fault, what is it like if we turn our mind to things like gratitude and respect? Thank you for being there for us. Thank you for your contribution to the world and to the great tapestry of the different religions and views. It's great to have more than one view of doing things. Because when you have that more than one view of doing things, you can put everything together and get a much better idea of how we can go forward. That's why that in Buddhism we like to collaborate. Not just to think that you have got the whole story. That's why I take stories from all different parts of all religions. Try and put them together so we have a much richer spirituality. Okay, let's get sort of a nice story from Islam to show just how we can respect a religion which has got a very bad press. One of the nicest parts of Islam was the Sufi tradition. And in that Sufi tradition, there was this fellow called Nasruddin, who was one of my heroes. So one of the reason why he was a hero is because he was always getting into trouble, saying the wrong thing. But he was really, 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 really smart. But one day, he had said something which upset all of the clerics. And they accused him of heresy. And so he had to go on trial in front of the king. And as the king heard the evidence was really conclusive and condemning. The king said, I've got no choice but to convict you of heresy. And the punishment, the only punishment I can give you, is capital punishment. You will have to be executed. And the Nasruddin, the spiritual leader, said, oh, okay, but it's such a great shame, because I was just about to teach your wife the meditation so she never argues with you ever again. And at that, the king said, what did you say? Oh, it's this type of meditation where if you practice it, that your wife will never ever argue with you ever again. And the king was quite intrigued. What, you know that type of meditation? And they said, I know all types of meditation. I'm a spiritual leader. And the king said, okay, I'll do a deal with you. I'll give you 1 year to teach my wife how to meditate so she never ever argues with me, because that's really important for me. It'll make my life very wonderful. But if after 1 year she's argumentative, not only will I execute you, I will attend and watch you die. And the priest, Nasruddin, said, fine, great, okay. And when he went out of the court with 12 months grace to teach his wife, the sultan's wife, how to meditate so she wouldn't argue, his friend said, do you really know a type of meditation to stop wives arguing with their husbands? He said, of course not, there is no such thing. It never happened. It's against nature. But why did you say that? Well, look, I've got another 12 months. Who knows what might happen? I might die of a heart attack in 6 months. Or, the king may be overthrown. Who knows what might happen? I've got 12 months extra. And the future is uncertain. And I love that little story. Because sometimes I get into trouble. And sometimes you try and talk your way out of it. Just to give yourself a bit of time. Because in time, things always change. That's why even today when somebody asks me, to do something, I always tell them and said, well, I'll think about it. I shouldn't actually tell you this because this is my trick. Because if you say no, they will argue with you. They argue and argue and argue. But if you say yes, as a monk, I have to keep my promises. I keep very strict rules. If I say yes, I'm going to do it, I have to do it. If I say no, they'll argue with me. So the way out is I'll think about it. There's some things you asked me years ago I'm still thinking about. it's a great way out. But anyway, when you have the positive attitude instead of fault-finding attitude, so some of the parts of Islam I really find very funny and very powerful and very good wisdom. So you don't just dismiss things by always finding fault. You find another part of things. And even, we have these little ceremonies. We just had our New Year Day last week. This is Buddhism. It's a wonderful religion. There's three New Years every year which we celebrate. Why not? We celebrate, the Western New Year on January the 1st, the Chinese New Year, and last weekend was the South Asian New Year, which is India, Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, Cambodia, Laos. It was their New Year. So why not celebrate three New Years? So this is much better than Christianity. You only have one New Year a day. A year. We have three New Years in Buddhism, so three celebrations for 1 year. But anyway, sort of at that ceremony, we always have these beautiful forgiveness ceremonies. And those forgiveness ceremonies are very powerful because, again, it's stopping all the fault-finding and seeing the beauty and positive things in life. At that ceremony, it's usually it's always a case over in Thailand that it's the children go to see their parents and they ask forgiveness of their parents and other elders at that time of the year. They bow down to their mum and dad and tell their mum and dad whatever I've done by body, speech and mind over the last year, or things I didn't do which I should have done, I ask forgiveness. Now we've taken that into part of our ordination ceremonies. If ever you go and see the ordination of a monk or a nun, we're going to have one on Waisak Day, we get these Australian young men and young women bowing to their parents and saying to their mum and dad, they may be 23, 24, 25, and they bow to their mum and dad in public and say, "Mum, Dad, thank you so much for all you've given to me over these years. And if there's anything which I've done to you which has irritated you or hurt you, I sincerely ask your forgiveness." And you see, so many times the mum and dad get teary-eyed, even like tears roll down their cheeks. What a beautiful ceremony that is. Before they leave the home to join the monastery, they ask forgiveness. It's a beautiful sense of respect. Let go of all the fault-finding. And show this wonderful sense of respect. And the parents, they get so emotionally charged. What a beautiful thing that is, to give forgiveness a second time to the man with the mobile phone. That's another parking meter in Perth for the future. A long time ago I told a story. I haven't told it for years. There was a big tree in the forest. Big bark, lots of branches, wonderful leaves, and every year an abundance of fruit. And there was this young boy who would like to go to that tree in the forest and climb up the tree and play in the branches of the tree. And even though that sometimes the boy, being boisterous, would actually knock some bark and injure that tree, the tree never minded. In fact, the tree loved this young kid walking all over it and climbing. And later on, when the boy grew a bit older, the tree missed being climbed over. But then the boy came back a few years later. He was a young man, and he needed to get to university but could not afford it. And the tree suggested to the young boy, "Take my fruit. Every year we have lots of fruit. Take it all and sell it and use it for your university." So for 4 years in a row, the young man stripped the tree of every fruit, sold it in order to get to university. And the tree was so happy to give the fruit to this young boy, which he loved. Later on, the boy never came back for a couple of years. And he came back saying that he'd fallen in love, was about to get married, and needed a house. And the tree said, "Take my branches. The branches are very thick. They've got lots of solid wood in there. Take the branches and use it for your house. And take the leaves, as they do in Asian countries, and use those for your roof. The smaller twigs you can use for the walls, the wattle walls. Take them, build a house. I just want you to do that." And so the young man took all the branches and twigs and leaves, just leaving the trunk. That really hurt the tree, but was so happy to give so much to this now young man who was getting married. Sometime later, after many years, the man came back again. Now he said to the tree that his business was in trouble. He needed something to keep it going again. And the tree said, "Take my trunk, that's all I have left to give you. There's some really strong, precious wood here. You can use this wood for your business to make furniture. Take it." So the man sawed all of the trunk up and made it into beautiful furniture. And later on, he came back again, this man. He was old now. And the tree was dead, just the stump was left. And the old man leant against the tree and put his head on the roots and thanked the tree for helping him with his life. That tree is the father, the mother, the parent. The little boy is your kid, climbing all over you when you're very young, asking for money for university, asking for help to build your first house, and even with your business. And even though the little kid stripped everything from the tree, leaving only a dead root, still the tree was always happy. And that's what parents are like. You can strip everything from them and they're happy. That's the symbol of a parent, a mother and a father. And they do that. So sometimes it's very easy to be grateful to your mother and father for all they give. But they don't give that grudgingly. You give that happily. Isn't that beautiful? The idea of a parent, a mother, or a father. When you look at them in that way, you get this beautiful sense of gratitude. Look at the teachers. Those teachers, no one would teach in a school in Australia for money. There's much better ways, less stress, to earn money. People do that, you know, because they have this will, this wanting to help, to serve, to take kids and make them into better people. You know that once, many years ago, I received an invitation in the post to give a keynote address at a seminar here in Perth. It was an educational seminar, I think the Western Educational District, I'm not quite sure now. They divided the school districts in Perth into East, West or South or something. And it was one of those districts, maybe one of three or four districts around Perth. And you know, when I received an invitation like that, I didn't know why. Why do you want me to give a keynote address at this conference? But I was intrigued enough to go, especially when there was a free breakfast. And when I turned up, this one of the organizers came right up to me. And she said, "Do you remember me?" And I said, "No, I haven't got a clue who you are." And these days, I think I mentioned this a few weeks ago, these days I give a much better response, because this happens all the time. People come up to you and they keep on asking, "Do you remember me? How can I remember you? There's so many thousands of you." So these days I have this wonderful response. They say, "Yes, I remember you. You're the person whose name I keep forgetting." Now that's a very, because it's honest, but you know, it means gives people a bit of respect that they're special. So that's a good line to use when somebody comes up to you. But anyway, I said, "I don't remember who you are." And then she told me the story. She'd invited me to this conference out of gratitude, because I didn't know what I'd done. And then she explained it to me. It was at her school, I think it was in Kelmscott, you know, about 5 or 6 years earlier. I'd gave a talk, and I'd inspired her so much that she sent in her letter of resignation that night. She was a principal, but she wanted to do something else with her life, something more important, because she noticed there were many children here in Perth who don't go to school, who won't go to school, who live on the streets, get involved in crime and prostitution at a very young age, and drugs. So she wanted to try and do something for them. And it was a story I told. It was the old story of the Emperor's Three Questions. I won't tell it in full because it's in my book. You've heard it many times. When is the most important time? The answer is now's the most important time. That's why she sent him her resignation that night. She wasn't going to wait. Now's the only time she has. Who is the most important person? The person you're with. Yeah, the one right in front of you. That's the most important person in the whole world, whoever that happens to be. And so she went out onto the streets at night with these kids, you know, 13-year-old prostitute girls. Kids, 14-year-olds, already got a huge record with the local police. And when she talked to them, that person, that 13-year-old prostitute, that 14-year-old drug dealer, was the most important person in the world for her. Which meant, for the first time probably in those kids' lives, someone was respecting them and listening to them and taking them seriously. And that's when she asked, you know, "What's it like? What can we do? How can we get you back into school?" And the third thing, what's the most important thing to do, was to care. And that's the philosophy she used. Simple. She went to the education department, the old Silver City in East Perth, sweet talked the bosses to get funding, and started this system designed not for what you would think kids need, but what they said they needed to get them back into school, a special school. And it was highly successful, which was why that she was one of the speakers at this little seminar, and so was I. But I always remember being totally upstaged by this 17-year-old kid, this boy, who went up in front of the microphone. He was not that articulate, but what he said of where he came from, an abusive parents, running away very young, getting into trouble and more trouble until this lady came up and respected him and cared for him. He could feel it and was listening to him, not telling him what he needed, but listening to him. And he got back into the system at his own way, in his own space, got his year 12s, and he announced he got a place at university. And when you hear where this kid came from and how well this works, even I sort of started getting wet-eyed. He totally upstaged everybody else just because of the story and how it does actually work. It's so easy, isn't it, to see a kid dealing drugs, being violent, women selling their body at such a young age and being fault-finding. Is that really going to solve the problem? So instead, when we have a bit of respect and care, it's amazing just the solutions we can find to the big problems in the world. And she said, I'm asking you here just because I really want to say thank you and have gratitude. What beautiful moments that they are when people say thank you and show their gratitude and show their respect for things which are beautiful in this world. So I took that on board and run with it all my life. Even you know that the times I spent in prisons, and I can't find fault with anybody. I don't even look for the faults. And these people have done terrible things in their life. Because I know if I find fault and have that type of mind, which the Buddha said don't do, then there's no way forward, there's no way out. But instead I have this gratitude, I'm grateful and respect these murderers and rapists. And this is tough stuff, it's big stuff. But I can do that, and if I can do that, if I've learned to do that, can't you do something similar? And the change which happens is immense. You see these people, for the first time in their lives, someone is respecting and caring for them. And that, first of all, that rocks them, that turns them upside down. What, you mean you don't hate me? You don't want to sort of kill me? You know what I've done? Yeah, I know what you've done. I know everything. But I'm not going to hate you. And from that moment onwards, a transformation starts to happen. And these, it's amazing to see what happens. Oh, you all know, Robert, our monastery, one of the prisoners recently got parole. He's now Anagarika, a Bodhinyana monastery. Isn't that nice? I'm very proud of that. Hope we get more. So they're really nice people. These people have been imprisoned. I know we had a retreat on once, and this is actually for the Singaporeans. They came on our retreat and had this prisoner. He managed to get permission to come and do all the cooking for the retreat. And if those people from Singapore had known what this guy had done, you'd have locked your doors. You would. But he was such a great cook, and he did such a wonderful service, and people were so thankful. They all shook his hand and said, thank you so much indeed. And they never knew what he'd done. Which was the real Carl? Was it the person who'd done his terrible crimes, or was it a brilliant cook who was so friendly and kind to everybody? The fault-finding mind would keep him locked in that badness forever. The mind of gratitude, respect, compassion, forgiveness, all this beautiful stuff, takes them out of the pain and hurt of their past gives them a new life, and totally transforms them. That's why, instead of the fault finder, the gratitude mind, the tree who can give everything, there's something beautiful in that. Something, and thanks. You know that there was one of the monks once, he went to hospital for some sort of treatment. And he was just alone, I think it was in Fremantle Hospital. And afterwards, I asked him, I said, no, how'd you go? He said, oh, people were so kind over there. The nurses were great, the doctors were really helping, even the food was okay. And I said, well, why don't you say thank you? And he actually did. He wrote to, I think it was McGuinty, he was the health minister at the time. He wrote to McGuinty and said, oh, thank you, I had a great stay, people were really looking after me, thank you so much. And he got a personal letter back from the minister. Because he said, I was amazed. I don't usually get letters like this from ordinary people saying what a great job I'm doing. Isn't that awful that people who really put their heart into trying to do something good for our world, all they ever get is caricatures of themselves looking like pigs in the local papers. You know, just telling all sorts of terrible things about them. No, I think we need a world with much more gratitude to people. And when you're grateful to a person, they usually live up to your expectations rather than living down to your fault finding. This is basic psychology. If you stop criticizing the person you live with and instead pointing out all the wonderful reasons why you married them in the first place, their beauty, their kindness, whatever else is them. If you stop that fault-finding mind and develop the perception of the beautiful, you see it there. There's heaps of beauty in every human being. I've never, ever seen any human being who's not got a huge amount of beauty inside of them, goodness and purity. It just needs to come up. And if you look for it, they see it too. It grows and they become amazing human beings. So you can change the person you live with. It's not that men are from Mars and women are from Venus. If that's how you look at them, then, you know, that you've got no hope at all. They're not. Women are from planet Earth. So are men from planet Earth. You get to that earthiness inside and bring that up, and you find that what you look inside a person which is beautiful, the perception of the beautiful, gratitude, kindness, thanks, that changes people. And that also, as I mentioned during the meditation, that changes the way you find peace in this world. To be grateful to be here. It's very easy to find fault, isn't it? Too hot, too cold, too early, too late. That's what the Buddha said. I can't meditate now. No, this is good enough. When you have this beautiful sense of grateful and perception of the beautiful, that means you can take a rest. Yeah, it's not finished yet. There's so many things to do. I'm not perfect. The world is not perfect. That is the reason why people always keep working so hard. One of the reasons why we never rest, we're always rushing around doing things, because we see there are so many things to do. So how can we stop that? We have the perception of the beautiful. Yes, there are so many things to do, but there are also so many things which have been done. That is my old piece of advice to you. After coming to a talk here on a Friday evening, when you go back home, don't go into the kitchen and start washing up and cleaning everything. Before you ever wash up in the kitchen, you must always count the dirty cups and plates, and then count the clean ones in the shelves. And if the ones in the shelves are in the majority, quit while you're ahead. Now that is not just a joke, okay? This is serious meditation business. Because if you're always someone who has to clean up every cup and saucer and plate, you'll find you'll never have any peace in your meditation, because you're always having to fix up everything in the past and the future, everything in your body, every defilement in your mind, you have to fix it up. And it is endless. Washing up. Is there ever an end to washing up? Never, ever. To washing up. Is there ever an end to finishing all the jobs you have to do in life? There's never an end to that. So if you want to have some peace, so even though the dishes need to be washed up, even though just all these bills have to be paid, even though all these calls have to be answered, not now. I'm going to take a break. It's good enough. I've answered enough emails for today. I've done enough business for today. Now, I'm going to have this perception, not of fault finding, of seeing all the things which need to be done. Seeing all the things which have